Periodically, maybe with some regularity, I look at the newspaper and particularly look at page 2. On the bottom left, there's a section that deals with history. What happened on this date? And I enjoy looking at that as I have opportunity. And this past week, I noticed in Wednesday's paper that it was 29 years ago when there was a particular event that happened. Do you remember Krista McAuliffe? She was the school teacher who died along with the other 6 crew members of the Space Shuttle Challenger when it exploded 73 seconds after liftoff from Cape Canaveral on January 28, 1986. That was kind of a memorable occasion. As a matter of fact, you might remember where you were when that happened. I do, very specifically. But think about that for a moment. To me, it was one of those events that you sort of stood still, and it was sort of captivating. It caused you to think. On the one hand, you were drawn to wonder, was this just a tragic waste of life? Was it an unnecessary, useless, and expensive sacrifice for the sake of space exploration? Then there may be some other thoughts, like, what would it have been like if you had been in that space capsule when that event happened? That's kind of sobering. A little scary. I remember having those thoughts. Can you imagine how incredibly strange, scary, disturbing? I mean, we can't really even imagine. But there have been numerous tragic endings like that. We've had several aircraft that have either disappeared or crashed into the ocean. It took some time to find. There are some of us who probably don't really care for flying because we have some of those images. And the thought occurs to you, what does it feel like when this happens, and you kind of don't want to dwell on it too much? And here I am, dwelling on it. Because sometimes we need to. We need to think about that. And our passage today in Scripture causes us to have to come to grips with that if we focus on it just a little bit. So I think there are some sobering things to think about. So I'm going to draw our attention to Hebrews chapter 9. I want to go back to verse 15, get a little bit of context. as I've noted before, the book of Hebrews is essentially one message, and it just continues, and we keep taking little chunks here and there. And also we've noted that the author brings up a topic, hits it from this angle, brings up another topic, hits that one, and then comes back to the first one, and then kind of goes back and picks up something, and then it hits it again from another angle, and so on. So after a while, you're thinking, well, we've gone over this before, but oh, you're looking at it from a slightly different angle, or considering some other aspect, or you're trying to make it a matter of accumulation, so that by looking at all of this layer upon layer, it's like you're overwhelmed with the overall point that Christ is the ultimate, don't go back to the old. And that's kind of the focus. So, looking at Hebrews 9, beginning at verse 15. And for this reason, he is the mediator of the new covenant, by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where there is a testament, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. For a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. Therefore, not even the first covenant was dedicated without blood. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you." Then likewise he sprinkled the blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. And according to the law, almost all things are purified with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no remission. Then he comes to the section we're looking at for today. Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with blood of another. He then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation. So I want to look at this passage and look at it in three parts. And it just sort of happens that it's two verses, and two verses. And while I'm not going to look at every single element that's in there, I want us to at least get the big picture. And one of the points that's communicated is the practical typology of sacrifice. And again, the text says, therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things, and copies there is tupos, or type, where we get our word type, are types of the things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies or types of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. And he's obviously making the point that there are copies, there are things that we can relate to and identify with in the real world that have been part of the cultic ritual, the religious experience, that are associated with the temple worship and the sacrifices and that whole business, all of which had their place, but they were anticipating something that had a heavenly significance, which is what Christ had to do with. So the sacrificial system was a type of the ultimate sacrifice. And this should be somewhat elementary in one sense, but it helps to sometimes see it sort of stated more plainly. The established system used earthly images and objects because that's what we need. We need something visual. And so when Christ instituted the Lord's Supper, for instance, he used something that we could see that would tie us to history and time and place, but had significance that went far beyond that, that had a spiritual and heavenly implication. So this then, the sacrificial system was a teaching tool to communicate truth. It taught the idea that payment was needed for sin. You sacrificed a lamb or a cattle or a goat, and those cost money. They were in an agrarian and herding culture, and so that was their forms of money that they utilized. So it cost them something, and they would see this creature die in their place, and that obviously was significant. So it was imagery they could relate to, and it should have had some very clear significance. I mean, who wants to take something that is going to cost you and kill it when the only reason you're doing that is to pay for your sins? They could relate to that picture. One point that needs to be recognized, though, is that there was no efficacy in the system itself. No actual physiological covering for sin in the system. The system didn't do it. It simply symbolized something. The shedding of blood illustrated the loss of life for sin, because the wages of sin is death, and therefore there needed to be death. But the person themselves couldn't provide it ultimately. So there was this picture of a death in their place, and that substitution was part of what Christ was going to fulfill. So they were anticipating the provision from God Himself, even though the people at that time didn't know exactly what the nature of that provision was. They saw the picture, they saw the imagery, though they didn't know exactly. There's a one-to-one correspondence here between Christ, their Messiah, Jesus, their Messiah, and the sacrifice that they were doing. They just knew that this was, if they obeyed God in this, it was a covering for their sin, anticipating that they were, that this was part of God's plan, and He would bring it to its completion. But they only needed to know so much at that time, and that's what they knew. The sacrifice of Christ gave meaning to the sacrifices. The anticipated death of Christ paid sin's debt. It was a temporal act that had earthly significance. When the sacrifices were made, it was something that was done that they could relate to, but it had significance outside of the actual act itself. And how it could be viewed is as an advanced payment. They had this activity, which was a type of what was to come, what Christ was going to do, even though they didn't know all the details, but they were trusting that this service to God was a temporary covering for their sin. So it was like an advanced payment. It would be like an employee asking their boss for a check in advance, anticipating that it would be paid later. Now, we don't usually recommend that. You can try it, see how far that gets you, but especially in today's world when things are changing so frequently. But the picture that we need to see, the problem with our context is we can't be sure that it's going to be paid. Or, let's say if someone is wanting to get an advance on their check, who's to say that they're not going to be sick or they're not going to terminate their job? They get the advance payment, you have no guarantees. Well, what about Christ's payment? If they are banking on the sacrifices that they're doing in the Old Testament, assuming or anticipating from God's perspective, even if they didn't know it, God is banking on, or they are basically banking on, God's promise that this is really going to happen and they can trust it. And so what it tells us is the heavenly provision was so certain, so sure, that they could trust it and that it would provide for them. Even though it hadn't happened yet, they were banking on it as though it had happened. Now, there's a sense in which you can think about the text that said Christ was the sacrifice that was slain before the foundation of the world. And so in God's mind, why wouldn't it be? He's outside of time anyway. But practically, the sacrificial system was a temporary covering. It was sort of an IOU from Christ, even if they didn't know the exact nature of how that was going to be accomplished. But those sacrifices would have no significance were it not for the reality that was guaranteed to come to pass in the future through Christ. So that's a key element that we need to remember. It had meaning only because Christ would pay the penalty. And so there was symbolism, typology, all of that was involved in the process. And just going through the motion wasn't enough. It was the faith that provided the efficacy, the covering for sin. If someone, for instance, saw someone bringing a sacrifice and they thought, oh, that looks like a great thing to do. I think I'll do that. I haven't killed a sheep in a while. Maybe I'll just kill a sheep and see what that feels like. See if that makes me feel better. Now, I don't know about you, but it wouldn't do anything for me. It's the faith that this provision satisfies God's requirement for the moment. That's the understanding. So there was faith involved. Otherwise, there was no covering. And you recall, if you've read through several different places in the Old Testament, where there was a rebuke against the people for bringing sacrifices, bringing empty sacrifices, because there was no heart there. So it's the faith that's necessary. So faith is involved all the way along the picture. And of course, the author of Hebrews is going to deal with that when we get to chapter 11. The whole thing about faith, that's pretty significant. So then we come to the next couple of verses, the judicial implications of sin. Looking at the text, not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place every year with the blood of another, thinking about the Day of Atonement. He then would have to have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world. I mean, if what Christ did was on the same par as what the high priest did, then he would have to go through that process routinely as well. But the whole point is that what Christ did is not on the same level. What the high priest was doing was anticipating what Christ was going to do. And so he did it because it was temporary. It was an imagery. It was symbolism. It had some element of efficacy only based on the faith that they had, that this is how Christ, or how God was providing for their temporary covering. And that only had significance because of what Christ was ultimately going to do. So it says, he then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, and looking at the once at the end of the ages, may likely have in view the idea of at the end of the Old Testament era at that time, because that's about what the time frame was, not knowing how many ages there yet may be coming after that, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And there's that critical element dealing with the problem of sin. So we want to think about the sufficiency of Christ's sacrifice. The unique singularity of his death was sufficient for all people of all time. It never had to be repeated. It didn't have to be redone. It wasn't going to wear off. It was complete and sufficient. I mean, there are so many things that we do that need to be repeated. How many of you have ever had to repaint anything? I remember when we were living in, Michigan, we had a house that had painted siding. And I thought, sure, it'd be nice not to have painted siding because you have to scrape it. I mean, all the prep work is worse than the actual painting, but I remember going through that. We had a white picket fence, had to go through that. And all the other kinds of maintenance things that we have to, I mean, we even have to, you know, take a shower every so often, hopefully, because we just need maintenance. But this was once and for all. I mean, I think of a lot of things I would like to be once and for all. But sometimes I don't want to have to deal with what would be required to bring that to pass. And you can think about what that means. So the Old Testament priest needed regular sacrifices, whether it be daily or weekly or yearly, because it was a picture of what was coming, so it had to be done routinely. It was temporary, and it was a teaching tool as well. The sufficiency of Christ's death was based on his personhood. Not just anyone could do what Christ did. We've been reminded of that. We know that. I mean, he was the mediator between God and man. He was the God-man. And he was the perfect sacrifice. So there's no one else like him. No person in history has ever been good enough. Abraham wasn't. Moses wasn't. David wasn't. Paul wasn't. Peter, John, Mother Teresa, Billy Graham, Martin Luther, John Calvin. You go through history and look, these are some pretty good folks. Nobody. And I hate to tell you this to your face, but not even you or me. There is none righteous, no, not one, except Christ, because of who he is. So it's his nature. No one else has moral perfection, complete perfection. No one else has ever lived a sinless life. No one else is the living Son of God and a perfect man. The union of undiminished deity and perfect humanity in one person who could do that. Then the meaning of Christ's death. What is the significance of his death? What does that mean? There's been debate about this throughout church history. And interestingly, after, I think it was Origen, who came up with the ransom to Satan view, that Christ's death was necessary in order to provide a ransom to pay Satan off so he'd get off God's back. Now, if you think about it, there's some way that you can try to imagine that, but you know that's not really an adequate response. So don't waste too much time trying to figure it out. There is another person named Peter Abelard who had another idea. And it was basically a matter of Christ's death was a loving or a beautiful example of a loving self-sacrifice. And we can learn from that, and that seeing what Christ did should draw us to God, realizing all that God did in sending his Son. And it was a loving thing, and it's true. I mean, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And you can find a number of passages that say that that's the case. But is that all? Is it merely a beautiful example of loving self-sacrifice? This view is called the moral influence theory of the atonement. And it's mainly illustrative. It's a picture. It didn't do anything in particular other than just give us a picture of what God did in sending Christ, and what Christ did in dying on the cross and paying the penalty and so on, just focusing on it as a loving thing, because otherwise it makes God out to be an ogre. I mean, why does he need that? But then someone else, fortunately, Anselm, comes along and he says, no, it's a payment for sin to satisfy God's justice, because God is a holy God and he can't tolerate sin. And so his holiness demanded payment for sin. Anselm was about 1033 to 1109, just to give you a ballpark time-wise. So in the middle of the Middle Ages. And this was called the satisfaction theory of the atonement. It was light years ahead of the ransom to the devil theory and also the moral influence theory. And so he was basically saying a penalty needed to be paid for the infraction of God's holy character. His justice required this penal judgment. And so a payment was necessary, but man couldn't provide it. Now, if you're listening to this, I hope you're thinking, well, yeah, isn't that obvious? I mean, isn't that what the Bible teaches? And the answer is yes. But obviously also, there are others who have looked at it from different angles, and I think it's pretty clear that this is the correct understanding. One way to try to look at it, if I have my my illustration in line here, just imagine a great philanthropist who does many wonderful things for other people. And there have been many of them. But just imagine this particular philanthropist who has given money and done great things is convicted of extorting money from his workplace and also cheating on his taxes. Would it be adequate to simply say that his good deeds as a philanthropist outweigh his bad deeds? Because maybe his company was not that great of a company, and so he's really doing a good thing. So when we sometimes think, well, if the good deeds outweigh the bad deeds, then that should be pretty even. We should come out okay. I mean, it was for a good purpose. I mean, he was extorting money so that he could give it away to people that had needs. Doesn't that sound good? Would it satisfy the employer and the government to simply have someone come along and volunteer to pay back the money that was extorted or withheld from the IRS? Isn't there something missing in that exchange? There's still a problem of needing justice for the wrong that was done because there was a true violation of the law in that case. Well, we have a violation of God's law, God's character, even, which is the basis of his law. And so God's holiness and justice have been violated. And just having an example of self-sacrifice is not going to do it. What Christ did was an example of self-sacrifice, but it was more than that. It was a matter of satisfying the justice of a payment that was made in accordance with the expectations of the law. The soul that sins, it shall die. When Adam and Eve were told what they could do in the garden, they disobeyed. You can eat from any tree except they disobeyed. So they were told that in the day that you eat, you will surely die. And so there was that picture that was there. So we needed a sacrifice in our place to pay that penalty. That's the picture. Then we move to the last section, the spiritual motivation of judgment. Hebrews 9:27-28 says, "And as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time apart from sin for salvation." And that last phrase, we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. We've touched on that before on a previous occasion. It's talking about those who eagerly wait for him, talking about those who are faithful. That last verse 28 there, last section of it. He will appear a second time apart from sin during the first advent. That's what that's talking about, is when he came to pay for sin by dying on the cross. That's the first advent. But he's going to come again a second time for salvation. That is for the consummation of our salvation, so that on that occasion, that's when the resurrection is going to occur after that, where we will be completely, because we're a whole person, we'll be reunited with our body in the resurrection. So that's the picture that's there. So we want to think about the finality of death. Men die once as a penalty for sin. We kind of know that. We've seen that in Scripture. We all face the same end in some form or another. And there's plenty of evidence that all die. The Bible clearly indicates this. Personal experience testifies to it. We've seen it happen all around us. But what about exceptions? Are there any exceptions to this? Well, if you're thinking back to Genesis chapter 5, verses 22 to 24, you might think of Enoch. But does it say he died or didn't die? It doesn't really say. It just says God took him. Then what'd God do with him once he took him? Did he die on the way up? Was he translated on the way up? We're not told. What about 2 Kings 2:11? Elijah, he was taken up. Did they escape death? Doesn't say. That doesn't say absolutely. They may have. We are left to wonder, what about the rapture? Those who are raptured, won't they escape death? They will be changed, because you can't be in heaven in your current form. So my speculation is that which occurs at the time of the rapture is not unlike what might have happened in the case of Enoch and Elijah. My speculation. Take it for what it is. But what we can get from this is that in all of history, if there are only two exceptions, the universality is even more obvious. And so it makes it clear. And then we could go into questions like, why do we die physically? What happened to us? Why will we not die when we're in our resurrection body? What is there? I've heard that you can take cells out of the body and they can continue to live indefinitely if they're in the right context. But our bodies are programmed to die. Something to do with whatever Jim Hovis used to work on there. What's that called? Yeah, ultimately the second law, yeah. So anyway, we're in rough shape. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. Barring the one ultimate exception, which is the rapture. So, men die once as a penalty for sin. Christ died once as a payment for sin. That's the point that's being communicated here. He was a perfect sacrifice to satisfy God's holiness and justice. Jesus Christ satisfied every requirement that was needed to accomplish that provision for man's sin, to pay the penalty, the death penalty that we have on us. So his singular death could pay the penalty for all people of all time. And what's interesting, I think what's helpful to note, is in verse 28, the first part of the verse, it says, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. Well, what does he mean, many? It doesn't bear the sins of everyone? No, it's showing a contrast, the one versus the many. You've got one here and you've got a whole bunch over here. That's all it's pointing out. Don't look at it as, oh, it doesn't cover everybody. It's many. No, it's just, it's making a contrast. That's the picture. Well, then the last section here, the accountability of judgment. We all die. Got that figured out. Don't like it. Don't want to have to deal with it. Don't want to think about it. But what it says then is after that, there's the judgment. What does that mean? Death is a final end in one sense, and a startling transition in another sense. We often think about death. It's a culmination. The physical body dies, but the soul lives on to one day be reunited with the body, but the body's going to be a glorified body. And there's this startling transition, and what's it to? Where is it to? That needs to be considered. So there's a definite finality to death physically, but there's an inescapable transition to eternity spiritually, which also has physical implications because of the resurrection, which I'm not going to deal with right now. We'll save that for the first week of April, when it's Resurrection Sunday. But another thought is, we generally think that we have control in this life. What element of control will we have after this life? Does that make you nervous? Now, any of you who are a control freak, that's going to make you really nervous. So, what? I don't have control? I'm not in charge? I don't get to choose? I can't say, well, I want to stand in that line, or I want to stand in that line, or I want to go there. I just, whatever God decides is what I got to do? Really? I don't want to go. Sorry. Everyone is going. Where you go depends on the decision I make here and now. So I better choose right here, because that's going to affect what happens there. That's a little sobering. So the prospect of final judgment is daunting, disheartening, intimidating. The term judgment implies standing before a judge. That means there's some form of accountability, and there's some sort of standard by which one is evaluated. And what we also see is that ultimate judgment is in the hands of the Son. Now, isn't that interesting? John 5:22 says, "For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son." 5:27 of John, "And has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man." Doesn't say the Son of God. It says the Son of Man. What is that doing? And you could also look at Matthew 28:18. "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth," and so on. It identifies him that way. Why is the Son in charge of judgment of mankind? Because he's one of us. He's a peer. When we have judgments in our own nation, don't we have a peer trial? That's supposed to be. Supposed to be. That's what it says in the original documents. That's something we won't go into any further. Universal sin anticipates universal judgment. Since the death penalty is upon all men, then the future judgment is also the expectation of all men. We're all in the same boat in some sense. That is, we can anticipate judgment. It is universal in scope, but it's modified in kind. There is a judgment for all, but it's not the same for all. And so then we have to look at the nature of judgment. There are two classes of men according to the Bible: those who are redeemed and those who are not. Those who are not redeemed face an inescapable, tragic judgment from an offended, holy God mediated through Christ. It's called the Great White Throne Judgment, Revelation chapter 20. But there's some other passages that touch on a little bit as well. 1 Peter 4:5 says, "They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead." 1 Peter 4:17, "For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God." That's the believer, the redeemed. "And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God?" In other words, pointing out a huge contrast. It's not going to be the same. And if we're accountable, what about those who don't follow him? A couple more verses on judgment for the redeemed. 2 Peter 3:7, "But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." That doesn't sound like a particularly good ending, does it? Revelation 20:13. The sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them, and they were judged, each one according to his works. And then the ultimate end is found in verse 15, which I'm not going to project, talks about everyone whose name is not found in the book of life will end up in the lake of fire. And we look in the Gospels, we see the lake of fire was prepared for the devil and his angels. But those who follow him rather than following Christ are going to end up there too. And it has to do with an examination of one's deeds, life, choices, a particular choice, especially. Then judgment for the redeemed. Those who are redeemed face an examination of their works as believers. It's not eternal damnation, but it's as believers we will stand. John 5:24 says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, he who hears my words and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life and shall not come into judgment." That judgment is talking about the same kind of judgment that the unredeemed are going to face, but has passed from death into life. And so there is one kind of judgment that we will not pass into. And that's because we are the bride of Christ. We have a special relationship with the judge. But there are still expectations from the head of the church, Christ, for the church as to what we do, how we live. And therefore, we come to 2 Corinthians 5:10, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad." So as believers, we still face the judgment seat of Christ. But that is a different picture than what the Great White Throne judgment is. This is a judgment evaluating our works in terms of rewards. That the Bema seat, the Great White Throne, the judgment seat of Christ, the Bema seat, had to do with it was a place where rewards were given out at the end of athletic games and so on. So a couple other verses here. 2 Timothy 4:1, "I charge you therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing and his kingdom." So this is talking about a time frame of those who, the living and the dead, those who have died before Christ returns, those who are alive when Christ returns, and at his appearing, that will be the time where the first resurrection is going to take place, and the initiation of his kingdom, and the marriage supper of the Lamb, and we will then reign with him on the earth in that kingdom during the kingdom age. Taking a whole lot of texts and sort of shortening it for our time. 2 Timothy 4:8, "Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing." This is a recognition of one's contribution to the cause of Christ. 1 John 4:17, "Love has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so we are in this world." And the idea is there is that we are ambassadors of his love. And it's looking, again, to a time of accountability, not whether or not you're saved, but what will be? What is his evaluation in terms of how you have lived as one who is a believer? And just, I kind of run out of time, but just a quick note: the judgment of the Old Testament saints is not specifically specified in this context, but I suspect it will be similar to the church because they are also redeemed ones. And those who came before the law was given and those who came after the law was given and before Christ, so that they were not part of the church. Because the church has one designation, but in this context, I think that which happens with the church is going to be parallel with that which happens with the Old Testament saint. Whether the time frame is the same or not is negotiable. And somewhat of a summation. There's generally three uses of the word judgment. It can refer to eternal judgment, and that can be for the unsaved, but also for the believer for reward. That's eternal. That's an eternal judgment element. And then temporal judgment, that's that which goes on the earth while we are living. It has to do with practical consequences, societal punishment, divine discipline. And then there is personal judgment, that is my evaluation of self and others. And just to throw a verse in here that kind of touches on some of these different ones, at different elements, and this is Paul writing in, and he says, "For I know nothing against myself," that's personal judgment, "yet I am not justified by this." That can have an element of a personal judgment, justifying oneself, but it can also have the idea of an eternal evaluation, because there's someone else who judges me. "For he who judges me is the Lord." That can have this eternal, but it can also have a temporal element. "Therefore, judge nothing before the time." That's a personal judgment. "Until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of the heart." There's an evaluation, possibly regarding an eternal element, regarding our works or lack of them. And then it says, "Then each one's praise will come from God." So obviously there is that element involved there. Have you thought about the amount of emphasis in Scripture on judgment? Now, just in the Sunday school class this morning, when Pat was sharing with us on the book of Amos, was judgment mentioned a time or two? Kind of a lot, and as you look at a lot of the Old Testament prophets in their writings, a lot of emphasis on judgment because there's an expectation. And really, if you look at it, we don't have time to go into this, but salvation and judgment almost always go together. We'll have to save that note for another time. But there is a judgment to come with implications for all, both unbelievers and believers. Unbelievers face eternal damnation. Believers face evaluation for works and eternal reward. So there's a correlation between actions and eternity. And you could put also in there responses, our heart's response. But the most critical element is our response to Christ, because that ultimately determines our destiny. Do I accept Him? Or do I reject Him? Do I recognize His work for me as the ultimate sacrifice in my behalf? Something that we will be reminded of when we share together in the Lord's table in just a couple of minutes. Do I take God at His word? Or do I take my chances with the world? That's the question, isn't it? Do I take God at His word? Or do I take my chances with the world? A lot of people going with option two. But the text says it's appointed unto a man to die once, and after that the judgment. You can take your chances? The consequences of choice are extremely serious. Our departure from this life may not be as spectacular as that of the demise of the challenger. But that which comes after has an equivalency, no matter how dramatic our exit from this life is. We all face the same choices, the same kind of scenario. And it comes down to, what am I doing now? What are my responses now? What is my choice now?